From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made last week when President Trump weighed in on the accusations made by Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, a former classmate of Brett Kavanaugh in high school. As you almost certainly know, Dr. Ford says that while at a party, Kavanaugh held her down, tried to remove her clothes, and covered her mouth to stop her from screaming. The president, who has a long list of women who have accused him of assault, tweeted, quote, "I have no doubt that if the attack on Dr. Ford was as bad as she says, charges would have been immediately filed with local law enforcement authorities by either her or her loving parents. I ask that she bring those filings forward so that we can learn date, time, and place," end quote. He was mocking her. The president's mocking tweet received tens of thousands of likes and retweets, and it brought back a hashtag, "Why I Didn't Report." Using that hashtag, people, primarily women, told their stories and are telling their stories of why they chose not to tell authorities or sometimes not to tell anyone at all after an assault. The stories were wrenching and difficult to read. There are thousands of them. More come in by the minute. Several Connections listeners on Friday suggested we provide this hour as a chance to listen to women in their own words. And we understand, first of all, that no one who's been assaulted has any obligation to talk about it, to write about it, or do anything about it. So we want to provide as sensitively as we can a forum to hear from women about those experiences. Should they tell those stories? Should they choose to tell those stories? And if you want to email your story to us this hour, you can do so. You can write to connections@wxxi.org. If you'd like us to share your story, and if you want, you can include a name. If you don't want to include a name, let us know. You can also call the program this hour, and we're going to discuss it. And we're going to try to do so in a way that is good faith, that is fair, and let's have that conversation. Megan DeChateauvieux is here, CEO for Willow Domestic Violence Center. Megan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also here is Ilhan Ali, who is a stand-up comedian, a proud immigrant, and an intersectional feminist. Ilhan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us is Rachel Pazda, who's a medical secretary and a Navy veteran. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I guess I'll start with just Megan in this because, you know, with Willow and the work that you do every day of your life, really, these are the kinds of questions and issues that you deal with. And I wonder how you feel watching the last week unfold. Even in the last couple of hours, it feels like there's new allegations and there's new back and forth, and it just feels, I have just a sense of sadness. I wonder how you feel about it.
Feelings, my goodness, it's heart-wrenching. It's very hard to watch. It's hard to see all of this. It brings up a lot of personal issues of myself and my friends, and every person that I know has experienced something similar to this. And seeing how the response from the community is, the response from the media, both in positive and negative. I think that tweet was incredibly heart-wrenching to read. And I know that this "Why I Didn't Report" hashtag has been very difficult to read, but also incredibly empowering to see so many voices and so many stories. And I like that you said that no one has to tell their story. No one needs to tell their story. But I do see this incredible strength in numbers and the solidarity that's being demonstrated by women coming forward and men coming forward and sharing their story of sexual abuse. I know that 90% of sexual assaults on campus go unreported, which is an incredibly staggering statistic or estimate of what's happening in our community. And one of the "Why I Didn't Report" hashtags that I wanted to repeat that really struck home for me, and I think for so many of the women and men that we serve at Willow, is "This person didn't report because I weighed the pain and trauma of the assault with the pain and trauma of going to court, with a lawyer pulling apart every aspect of my life to justify why I deserved it. Moving on was the less traumatic, more protective option."
Let me ask our other guests to tell. They're here because they're willing to share their stories and they think it's important. And so, Ilhan, I'll start with you. And again, I want to just stress that I'm kind of leaving this open to our guests to discuss what you feel comfortable discussing. Go ahead.
Yeah. That last quote really struck home. You didn't even know that would hit me hard because the second time that I decided to talk about it, I did go to court. I did immediately report it. That same night, I went to the hospital. I had my roommate drive me. They went and arrested the person who I can say it now, the person who raped me in my home, exactly where I said he was. And that night in the hospital, the person who was supposed to be the same nurse arrived 3 hours later. I was not allowed to pee. the room was bombarded with four different men who were police officers who kept saying, oh, we're here to help you. And I was like, I don't want any men in the room with me while I'm barely wearing anything. And I was just kind of blamed. I was definitely blamed. They kept saying, oh, well, we're here to help you. You're not letting us help you. They weren't letting me deal with the situation the way that I wanted to. And that was not being attacked, not being surrounded, being given the time to process while I was in the hospital. I thought it would be a safe space, and it wasn't. And I almost got up and left. They wouldn't let me use the bathroom. Finally, 3 hours later, the same nurse arrived, and her first words to me were, oh, wow, I don't know why you're being so rude. I was woken up out of my sleep for this. I'm sorry for inconveniencing you. I was also woken up out of my sleep and didn't want to be. It was really traumatic, and it was awful. And for 14 months, I kept having to retell my story. I kept having to have a lawyer ask me, oh, well, what were you doing? Were you drinking? Oh, I see on your Instagram that you used to have an eating disorder. Could your pains in your stomach at the hospital have been from not eating? And also, I don't think lawyers, I'm just kind of trying to bring some funniness into, but lawyers shouldn't be allowed to wear aviators. It kind of just makes you hate them even more. Like, why are you wearing aviators in court? That was like one thing I tried to focus on the whole time is like, this guy sucks so much, he's wearing aviators in court. But just having the front row filled with the person who raped me's family staring at me, having the judge have to say, hey guys, don't laugh in court because I used a word to describe what happened to me, and everyone in court that was with his family giggled about it. Like, having to go home and remind myself, oh, I'm doing this because it matters. Having to walk down the street and see somebody who looks like him. Having to hear his name said for an order at Starbucks. Having to constantly relive it when the easier option could have just been, don't tell anybody, hope it goes away. But I didn't want to let it go away, because the first time it happened to me, it was a family member and I saw them all the time. And I did try to tell my mom. When I started to say my uncle's name, my mom said, no, just stay away from him. We're not going to talk about this. So being silenced for a really long time is not a fun thing. And then people being like, oh, well, women are finally speaking out about this. You know, why didn't they say it when it happened? We don't all process trauma the same way. We shouldn't shame people for finally being able to process their trauma, for finally being able to share their stories. You know, we should be celebrating it. We should be thanking them, because it's not the first time that they've thought about it. They're not finally talking about it. They're finally telling you.
When you describe your own family, was that the response that you expected at the time? I mean, were you nervous about what your family might say?
I told my mom 4 years later, and she just, I thought about it every time I saw her. I thought about telling her. And that was not the response that I expected, but I also had that in the back of my mind, like, this might happen.
Did it make it harder?
It did make it harder. It made me question what happened to me. It made me question my own judgment.
Have there been people in your life who have been supportive from the get-go?
They've been rare, but yeah, my boyfriend right now, my partner right now, is the most supportive person that I've ever met, and it like constantly blows my mind.
Family and friends? I mean, and here's part of the reason. I'm not trying to probe too much, Ilhan, to try to make it hurt. Mm-hmm. I'm bringing it up because when you share that even your mother's response was, look, just don't talk mm-hmm. about it. Just don't talk about it. Don't go near him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the concern is that people think that, well, if you just tell somebody, you're going to be supported. Particularly by the women in your life, particularly by you, the family in your life.
Yeah, it's not, people aren't always supportive. And the people that are saying this have never, well, even if they have experienced, because I can't say they've never, mm-hmm. even if they have experienced a situation like this, they're in denial themselves. Personally, for me, the person who I decided to report last year was another comedian. And as soon as I spoke up about it, the immense support that I got from the comedy community was ridiculous. They immediately decided to ban him. They all posted things asking people not to book him to protect the safety of other people. I mean, recently a famous comedian, Jeremy Piven, was booked at one of our local comedy clubs, and he has eight different women, who knows who else, that have accused him of sexually assaulting them. and he's still booked. And seeing that always blows my mind, because it's like, no matter how many people support you, there's still going to be awful people getting ahead in life who are, our president. Like, it's terrible.
I'm sorry what you've gone through. And I mean, it seems really trite. There's nothing much, you know, a lot of people can say, I guess. Rachel Pazda, I'll open the floor to you.
Okay. I think the first thing, something that's been going through my mind a lot this last week or so with everything exploding is, why didn't she come forward sooner? Why didn't she say something then? The phrase that keeps going through my head is, I don't owe you my trauma. Like, I have a right to process it however I want to, and I have a right to not say anything if I don't want to, for whatever the reason is. It's a valid choice for me to say, you know what, I'm not going to say something because I have this fear, because the fears are logical. They're completely reasonable. There is a lack of support. There is a lack of respect for women when they come forward, because there's this automatic, oh, what were you hiding sort of sense. And that happened for me when I was sexually assaulted twice when I was stationed in the Navy. I was in San Diego. And the first time around was absolutely debilitating to me. I remember exactly where I was. I have a general idea of the time, but I don't remember exactly what time it was. I don't remember the exact date. I don't remember exactly what I was wearing. But I do remember after it happened, not being able to sleep because he was right next to me for the rest of the night. And the first light of dawn, like literally the first light of dawn, I got up and I made the number one mistake that so many people say don't do, and I took a shower. And then I walked for, oh my God, I don't even remember. It felt like probably about 45 minutes to an hour, and found a bus stop. And for the first time in my life, I took a bus by myself back to base. And when I got there, I took another shower, and my friend who had been camping with me and this person and some other people who were there came to my room and was basically saying, you know, why did you leave? Why didn't you tell anyone you were leaving? We were so upset and scared. And when I told her what happened, this is someone who was my best friend, looked at me and said, oh yeah, he told us all about it, that you're just blowing things out of proportion. And when I was like, well, I think I should probably tell the police, like, shouldn't I tell, like, the chief, or shouldn't we tell one of the petty officers or someone who's in charge? Like, this is, you know, a bad person who did a terrible thing to me. And she was like, well, we all know he's that type of person, so you shouldn't have let him near you in the first place. So the very first time I was ever assaulted, someone I trusted more than anybody else at that point in my life was telling me, it's kind of your fault, and no, you shouldn't say anything. So I didn't. And I just, the constant anxiety I had, if I walked past him on the base, I would cross the street because I didn't want to have to be near him. I wasn't able to spend time with anyone that I was close to, any of my friends, because he was always there. And I couldn't, when I was in the same room with him, I would immediately start to shake, and I would get tunnel vision, and my ears would start to ring, and I couldn't be around this person. So not saying anything cost me so much that when it happened again about a year later, at the hands of someone else who I actually considered my friend and I trusted very much, never in a million years would have, if someone said, oh, this person's going to do this thing to you, I would have been like, he would never do that to me. Are you kidding me? And he did. And at that point in time, I, again, was traumatized. I actually had an out-of-body experience where I was actually watching everything happen to me. And when it was done, I left where we were and I went somewhere else and I had no way home. So again, I had to be with this person in the room with me for a couple of hours. And again, I couldn't sleep. And some girls who I didn't know came in and they were like, oh my gosh, you are, what's going on? You look terrible. And I told them what happened. They were like, we need to report this. We need to take you to the hospital. So they took me to the hospital and I reported it and I told, you know, what had happened. And I had to, unfortunately, I did not have a similar experience with the same nurse. I had a very, very compassionate same nurse, for which I'm incredibly grateful. Unfortunately, everyone around me other than her was male. And I was 20 at the time. I did not have the wherewithal to be like, get away from me. I didn't have the courage, the maturity to vocalize how uncomfortable and scared I was with those men in the room. So I didn't, which increased the level of trauma because not only was I scared because of what happened, now I was feeling extra fear of other people because of what had happened. And I decided to press charges, and everyone that was there, including the girls who had taken me to the hospital, said, oh, we've talked to him. What you went through is all in your head. You're imagining things. So I went through all of the steps I had to take. I did the rape kit. I did, you know, talking to the therapist. I talked to the police. I talked to the military police. I talked to everybody. And it kept coming back to, well, what were you drinking? I wasn't drinking anything. You were at a party. You had to have been drinking something. No, I didn't have to be drinking something. I wasn't drinking anything. And so the implication of, well, you're lying because we know you had to have been drinking something, to you're lying because he's not the type of person to do that. You're lying. He has a girlfriend. You're lying. You're lying. You're lying. You're lying. You're lying. And it got to the point that I quit. I dropped the charges because I was told that if I continued to press charges, that I would have to stay on base with him. And it was a small base. It wasn't the larger base across the bay. It was a small training base. His room was literally on the other side of the building from mine. So, well, you're going to have to be here in San Diego on this base for another 6 months to a year while we clear this up. And I was just like, I fold. I can't do that. Send me away. And they did. I was stationed on the other side of the country in Norfolk. And then I made myself forget. I made myself absolutely forget everything that happened to me. And it didn't work, unfortunately, in the long run. But for the short time being, I was able to survive. And then one of these individuals, the second one, actually showed up on my base, stationed on one of my friend's ships, my roommate's ship, and told her, hey, by the way, tell Pazd I said hi. And that just brought everything back up for me. And I had a complete meltdown and ended up losing my mind for a while and having lifelong, up to this point, ramifications that affected me for that. So I've been on both sides. I've been on the I didn't report and it traumatized me, and I did report and it traumatized me even further. So I completely understand why women hear my story. They hear your story. They hear so many stories. And it's just like, you know what? I have to weigh the cost. What price am I willing to pay for this? Because our society extracts a price from any woman who is willing to stand up and dare to persecute someone and attempt to punish someone for the crime they committed against them. And so we weigh the cost. And
Can I jump in? That's Megan DeChateauvieux, who's the CEO of Willow. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say thank you to both of you for your courage and bravery in sharing your stories. It's incredible to hear this and to be on air to say this to a broad audience, too. That's very powerful. And also for anyone listening, this can be really triggering and re-traumatizing, too, for survivors who are out there to hear these stories. And I would encourage anyone who's listening to call Willow's hotline, 222-SAFE, or the Restore Sexual Assault Services hotline at 546-2777. There is support out there for anyone listening.
And certainly, I think everyone understands the reason we're having this conversation this hour is not out of any desire to bring forth anything that's unnecessarily difficult or traumatizing. But right now, there's a conversation going on in this country in which a lot of Americans have questions about stories like this. And so let me read just a couple of examples of the kinds of things that we're hearing from folks. So just this morning, there were there were some new allegations that surfaced through The New Yorker last night in the Brett Kavanaugh case, and that sparked sort of new conversations this morning. And there was a number of people in sort of my Twitter sphere who were, and they were men, saying, boy, they kept using the word sketchy allegations, which is a word that certainly has a tinge of I don't believe it or not credible. And but I still try to engage. I try to say, in good faith here, let's just work through this here, because clearly you're having trouble with 35 years later and allegations that may not have the kind of corroboration that could lead to a criminal prosecution, but could at least have some sort of establishment of something for members of the Senate. And it's tough. I understand that. I mean, I'm trying to at least understand the concern. But I asked, in good faith, and this is what I said to Todd on my Twitter feed. I said, let's, in good faith, let's sort of explore this. What happens in a world where all these allegations that we're hearing last week are true? What should the women do? And here's what he wrote. He writes this morning, they should have remained silent. They should have spoken up when they had the chance, when the alleged offenses were within the statute of limitations and could be investigated more reasonably. Coming forward now, at the last minute, just looks like a political smear. And another person on that feed, Kevin, says, I wish the accusers had come forward sooner. If they did come forward sooner, I wish it would have been brought forward before even the letter to Feinstein. He says, it looks like this might have been saved as a silver bullet against the nomination. So, even if they're true, what these men in this case are saying is it's kind of too late. And I wonder what how our guests take that. What would you say to Todd and to people like Kevin who are writing this?
I think the stakes are higher right now. I think if you have allegations you've been keeping silent about for a majority of your life and you see the person that you're accusing who did this to you rising to power in our country, particularly a position on the Supreme Court, then you have an obligation to the rest of the country to speak up. And so you may have been protecting yourself, and now you may feel that you're protecting others.
Yeah, it's, I know he used the word silver bullet, but what sort of flashed through my mind was the Hail Mary pass of there's this group of women who are rising to the front and saying, we need to defend ourselves from this. And what can we do? What can we do? And all of a sudden this, you know, comes up and it's like, okay, well, we're not stupid. You know, we recognize that there's this, all of a sudden this information is coming up. Why didn't it come up before? We understand what it looks like. However, that does not negate the reality of this happened to this woman at the hands of this man. So, and there have been other allegations that have come up, as, you know, have been mentioned, and not just about women, but about the way he's lived his life, about the way he was when he was in his fraternity, the way he has spoken to people at graduation speeches, the things that he said makes you go, what is this man's ethical core? And that this woman was willing to stand up, you know, Dr. Ford was willing to stand up and say, hey, I can show you his core from the very beginning. That takes a special level of courage, the willingness to take that action in spite of everything that we know about what is or isn't happening in the past and the present. It's not something to just be dismissed the way that these men are trying to dismiss it.
Okay, come on.
I feel like, pardon me, I feel like there's no winning. If you report it, then you're ruining somebody's future. You're in it to be spiteful. You held it in your hand as some kind of card you're using against them. You're always going to be smeared. If you don't report it, then, like, oh, you're bringing up the past. You know, you're just, right. Why didn't you say something before? There's no winning. People are always going to find a reason to tear survivors apart, and it's awful.
On the subject of no winning, or, I mean, if you listen to the stories that Ilhan and Rachel have shared, if you don't report, there's a cost. If you do report, it is not easy, and it may go, in some cases, even worse. There's a story that I would really urge listeners to read that came out a few days ago in the Washington Post, a 3-year piece of work by Elizabeth Brunig. It's titled, She Reported Her 2006 Rape, Then Nothing Happened. In the Me Too Era, What Do We Owe Her Now? And you ought to read that by Elizabeth Brunig. It's a powerhouse piece of reporting, extremely well-sourced and thorough. And it's really, really worth reporting. Before I get a phone call from our listeners, if you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK, it's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Caitlin writes to us under the Why I Didn't Report hashtag on Twitter. She says, because I was only 18 and scared, because I had been drinking, because I froze in panic when he climbed on top of me, and I didn't tell him to stop, because I thought he was my friend, because I thought it was my fault. This person was a serial rapist. That's from Caitlin. Marilyn in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Hi, everybody. I'm 70 years old, and I was abused, sexually abused at 12, 13 by family member, and raped by one, molested by another. I won't say who. Anyway, I told my cousin after a fashion because I didn't know where to go, what to do, and it was a long time ago. Now I told my sister about 15 years ago, and my mother, who broke her apart, I told her before she died, and I regret that. But at the time, I got incontinent, a stool and urine, and I had no help, nobody to help me, and I was really... It affects me to this day, and my sexual feelings have been, compromised because of it. You know, I'd never had a very accommodating or nice or easy way with sex. So it affected me. I'm 7 years old now, and it affected me all my life. I'm also a lesbian, but it still affected me, and it's... To this day, I have no idea what I should have done. It was back in the 50s and 60s, and I was just, I was afraid to go home. That's why I became incontinent. And I just had a real hard time. I just wanted to let you know that it affects you for your whole life. And nowadays, it's even harder. Even if you tell somebody, it's even difficult. So I really feel for everybody out there.
Marilyn,
thank you.
Thank you for the phone call, Marilyn, and thank you for your willingness to share what has to be a devastatingly difficult story. I'm going to echo what Megan DeChateauvieux said earlier. I mean, to anybody who tells their story, they deserve our gratitude and appreciation because they're story by story, account by account, illuminating what often stays hidden, and that's their choice. But I'm so sorry. Marilyn, Megan, you want to add to some of what you heard? Unfortunately, I know you've heard many, many stories like that.
We have, and I want to echo the thanks to Marilyn for speaking up and sharing your story. I think I'm hopeful that times are changing. And I think with the hashtag MeToo, this hashtag why I didn't report, these heinous stories that are making it to the news, to the front pages, and the top of our nation's consciousness now, that things are transforming and the way that we will respond in the future to survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence and all of this will change for the better. I have been seeing on my social media news feed so many women in my life and older women who are coming forward now about the stories of what they experienced when they were children, when they were teenagers, when they were young women, and it's all too prevalent. We know these campus sexual assaults happen very often. It also happens to young girls. 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys, so it's not just limited to women, will be sexually abused by age 18. So that's so many of our young people that are experiencing this. And I think the more and more of us that come forward and say, me too, and it's not okay, the tide will change.
Dave writes to us and says, I'm crying and very angry. The appropriate response I know right now, and you're all making that imperative very, very obvious, the imperative for mass societal change and fast. That comes from David, who's listening to the program. So again, more appreciation for the very difficult stories our guests are telling. Let me read an email from a listener named Bill who says, Evan, I've heard you do many shows on how the principles of restorative justice might be considered as a way of moving from a mindset of punishment to a mindset of rehabilitation, particularly when applied to disrupting the school-to-prison pipeline. I'm wondering if these principles might also be applied to addressing the concerns of the Me Too movement. In the current climate, no avenues for genuine repentance and reconciliation are really available for any transgression, regardless of its degree. The reaction and consequence seems to be of a one-size-fits-all proportion. I've heard interviews this weekend on NPR say that a sincere admission of wrongdoing and recognition of the harm that was done to the victim is the one thing that does provide healing and can allow someone to move on, yet that doesn't seem to be offered as an option when the consequences for admission of any transgression amounts to lifetime shunning. Is there an acceptable path to redemption here? Could principles of restorative justice be applied to create that path? Megan Eshetteviu, I'll start with you on that question.
That's very, very difficult. Every situation is incredibly unique. I have not seen any literature showing that restorative justice works in the domestic violence realm. In sexual assault, survivors would have the choice to take that route or not. I think it could be incredibly re-traumatizing and triggering to be face-to-face with the abuser. And oftentimes, the abuser in the room will say whatever needs to be said to just get out of there without any real repercussions for their actions. And so the idea of restorative justice for bullying in schools, I find very effective. I have friends who do this work, and I think it's very powerful. When you're talking about sexual assault and domestic violence, I have yet to see it work.
Gohan?
I agree with Megan. When it came to offering pleas in my case, I did try to offer pleas that included mandatory therapy and things like that. I think it's great to try to ask the abuser to work on themselves, but I don't think it always works. I think that in most of these cases, the person who's assaulting you or abusing you is a sociopath and a narcissist. They usually just care about themselves. That's why their actions are exactly what they're doing. They're preying, and I don't think restorative justice will work. I think that also that mindset that we can save people who've decided to make someone else's body theirs or to claim ownership of somebody's body isn't fair. I read something online that said rape, you know, like sexual assault, it's the only time where the victim becomes the accused. And this whole we can save these men or we can save these women because, you know, it's not always just men isn't fair. It's not fair. I think that they should be fully punished. I don't think restorative justice will work.
Rachel?
I also agree with Megan. I personally have been on that side of it where I've been apologized to.
Did you take it as sincere?
Not particularly.
Okay. Because that matters here, doesn't it?
It does very much so. It was my second rapist, and he came up to me and said, you know, if that is what you think I did, I'm sorry. And I surprised myself by absolutely lambasting him. I gave him a very, very, very stern talking to for probably about 15 minutes and went inside and shook like a leaf for the rest of the night. It didn't help at all. And if anything, it did make it worse. I suppose I could see a situation where maybe it was someone's first time doing something like that, and they were legitimately not, you know, recognizing that this is something that the person that they're with doesn't want, and then they are truly appalled. But, you know, as, you know, my co-guest said, you know, if they're not willing to do the work on themselves of their own free will, if they're not willing to recognize, whoa, I seriously hurt that person with my actions, and I do not want to be that person. That's not who I am. And they're not willing to go and figure out who they are and why they did what they did and what inside of themselves made them think that was okay. I mean, what good is it? It just sort of comes down to almost like an extension of serving time and having to talk to somebody about something until they're done with it, and then they can go on with their lives. It's not going to do anything.
I suspect this is a really tough and complicated issue going forward that needs a lot more research. And number one, restorative justice has a lot of good research apart from this realm. As Megan DeChateau, you said, there's a lot of good research for restorative justice. And I would love to hear from the folks, for example, at the Gandhi Center, Kit Miller and the wonderful people there. Send me a note if you know of any research on this or if it's ongoing, because, you know, you want to believe that maybe there's a bridge here with something like restorative justice. But you also understand Ilhan and Rachel's skepticism. I mean, I understand. I also would point us to Caitlin Flanagan's piece in The Atlantic. Caitlin Flanagan has been kind of a critic of the Me Too movement, to say the least, a bit of a skeptic. But she wrote a piece a couple days ago in The Atlantic titled I Believe Her. And she wrote her own story of her own sexual assault in which she did not tell anyone for a long time, explained why, but did get what she took as a very sincere, unprompted act of apology from her attacker that she said did go for her a long way to healing. But she took it as sincere, it was unprompted, it wasn't forced, it wasn't court mandated, and those things are probably rare, unfortunately. So it's complex, and Bill, I do appreciate the thought on that. I've got a lot more. Yeah, you want to jump back in, Megan?
There's something to this, though. I think that we at Willow, we do see quite a few through our court program. We see repeat offenders, so abusers that come back with different partners, and they're the same people over and over who are getting into new relationships and abusing different women. And so I did find a statistic from the National Sexual Violence Resource Center that 63% of men at one university study who self-reported acts of rape or attempted rape admitted to repeat rapes. And yes. So these men are the same ones over and over and over who are doing this to women. And so there is something here, perhaps not restorative justice, but early education about relationships and really working on the prevention side to teach boys what is okay behavior in a relationship and to teach, you know, girls too what to expect.
This is why with Judge Kavanaugh, if I were on that committee, I would ask him about his high school yearbook, which normally you wouldn't think really matters. But here's why I think it does. Mm-hmm. I don't want, and by the way, this is apart from what Dr. Ford alleges. This is apart from the new allegations. This is just what he wrote in his own advertising myself proudly in a high school yearbook page. He talked about being in a keg club and boasting of dozens of kegs consumed. And his best friend in high school wrote memoirs about how they would get blackout drunk. And there are references in his high school yearbook that he makes to sexual conquest. There's some, you know, some stuff that I won't even go into detail that seems pretty clearly sort of sensationalistic, sexualized stuff. And all I would say is, I think that's bad for women. I think that's bad for the relationship that boys have with girls in high school, and they become men and women. And I would not want my son writing that stuff in a high school yearbook. So on the subject of contrition, apart from all of these, I would ask him, are you embarrassed by that? Is that okay with you if your kids write stuff like that in high school, boasting about sexual conquest as a big part of the accomplishments in high school and keg clubs? And I mean, I drank underage, sometimes more than I should have, but I didn't write that stuff. And I would not be okay with that. So that's kind of where I think it all fits into the puzzle here.
And he's not being held to task for his character the way that so many women are when they go through the system.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that doesn't mean that we can't grow up. But if we just accept that that's the boys will be boys stuff, we're in real trouble, I think. That's we got a lot more to weigh in with our phone call. So let me try to get through as many as we can. Dawn in Rochester. Go ahead, Dawn.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Yeah.
My heart is racing so fast just to be able to talk about this stuff. I am one of the older women. I recently just turned 68 and was raped in my late 20s. I never talked to anyone about it until I turned 50. And there are reasons that I'm not sure you discussed. You may have. I missed the first 20 minutes or so of the show. But one of them is there's a deep sense of shame for the woman. It's very, very difficult to get out of that and start to believe that you didn't do something wrong. Secondly, in the probably even the 50s, but the 60s and 70s, there was a culture of boys will be boys. Girls will be other words, you know, to have participated. So boys, I think, in our culture, got away with doing a lot of things in those years that were just kind of expected of them, or it was okay because they were boys. And I can't tell you how happy I am to see finally, after all these years, a little bit of a shift in the awareness and the culture of our society.
Don, thank you for the phone call. Are you seeing?
And
have you seen that?
Can I say, more thing?
Yeah, yeah, please.
I have one more thing to add, and that is that in the case of domestic or forced rape, violent rape, if you will, there's such a sense of terror in reporting the crime that that person is going to come after you. Hmm. He's going to come after you. You literally fear for your life. So I think that in many cases, that's also a reason why so many of these events go unreported.
Dawn, thank you. Ilhan, you wanted to respond. Go ahead.
Yeah, I actually just posted something yesterday, and it was a cross-stitch that I saw. It said, boys will be boys, and the second boys was crossed out, and it said, will be held accountable for their actions.
Yeah,
and I reposted it, and then it kind of hit me 2 minutes later, and I was like, no, they will not be held accountable for actions. Our society is backing down and letting these boys continue to turn into men who get away with things, and we're continuing to shame women. And I know, Don, you just called and said there's a huge sense of shame. As soon as I spoke up about being sexually assaulted and I went online with it, I had all of these people, men and women and other people, just messaging me, telling me about all of the times where they felt like they couldn't speak up because they were ashamed. I had my character pulled apart. I had people talking about that one time I was mean to them in high school and how I'm such an awful person. I had people questioning me as a person. I actually was working at a restaurant that let me go in a very suspicious way, where they just stopped putting me on the schedule because the girl that was scheduling couldn't handle how open I was. There's so much that you lose as a victim. But every time that I started to think, you know, maybe, like you were saying, you dropped it because you just couldn't handle it. Every time that my case got pushed back, or even when I thought I was going to go on stand, and I thought that morning, I can't do it. Can't do it. I'm wearing the skirt that I wore to court today. I haven't worn it since then. And I wore it here because I thought it would give me some courage. It just, everything that I wore that day, from how my hair was done, from what I ate, what I drank, where I walked to get to court, I think about it constantly. We lose so much as a victim, and yet we continue to hear, oh, boys will be boys, or, oh, you know, they're just doing what they know. Maybe we need to change that. People are uncomfortable, and they need to be. They need to find out why are we uncomfortable? Why does this make us feel weird?
Right. I know, like, Dawn, you said that you were, like, feeling shaky calling in. So, you know, thank you for having the courage to call in. But I feel shaky myself, you know. And we as women, we learn to hide that. We learn to, oh, my gosh, my heart is racing a million miles a minute and my stomach is churning. But externally, you would never know that. You know, we have this very calm, placid. I'm not going to say anything in a loud voice to offend you. I'm not going to try to get a rise out of you. How can I make you comfortable with what I'm saying? Because we don't know how someone's going to react. And so I think sometimes when someone does finally say something, people are like, oh, well, she couldn't possibly mean it. She's not really, doesn't seem to be that upset. It's like, well, I have this rather intense societal programming that I know I'm not allowed to be that way. And if I am that way, you're going to automatically dismiss it as I'm just being hysterical. So you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. And, you know, having the courage to speak up no matter how you're presenting it, it's a lot. You know, courage is not, you know, it's not an absence of fear. It's not like, oh, I'm just going to go in guns blazing and everything's going to be, grr, I'm going to win this. It's, oh my God, what am I doing?
And doing it anyway.
And doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, when people say to me, oh my gosh, you're so courageous. Thank you so much for your strength. I'm like, yeah, I wish you could be standing in my pants right now because I'm terrified. You don't feel courageous. So, you know, it's okay to feel that way.
And this is partly speaking to the impact of trauma.
Yeah.
And what trauma does to your brain.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And so when you experience something like this, to be able to rationally recount in chronological order every moment of what happened is next to impossible.
It is.
Because it really your brain is actually rewiring itself when you experience trauma. We see this with the ACEs studies with young children. If you've had one or more situations of extreme trauma as a child, your brain is rewired. It really does have a physical impact on you. And so when you try to speak about your personal trauma, it can be incredibly emotional, and it often doesn't come out in the logical, rational way that you would expect in a courtroom, which also makes it harder for people to tell their stories.
Can I also just ask, though, that is certainly understandable and true. Is it possible that you could ever mistake the actual person who did the assault to you, Ilhan?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Rachel?
No.
Ed Whalen, who has done a lot of work in GOP circles helping advise White Houses on Supreme Court nominees, including this time around, posted a long theory in which he concocted the idea that it was actually, that there was an assault on Christine Blasey Ford, but it was one of Brett Kavanaugh's classmates who looked like him. And then he has since retracted that theory and has been suspended from his job. But that was one of the ideas, that, well, maybe she just got the wrong guy. I don't see a lot of cases in Megan Chateauvieux, because, again, I want to get to one other quick point here, but most of the time, how rare is it, I guess I'm asking, for someone to actually miss the perpetrator?
Let me bring some more numbers in.
Yeah.
So 51% of female victims are raped by intimate partners and 40% by acquaintances. So you know the person who is sexually assaulting you.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. William emailed the program saying, Evan, how come you haven't brought up the phrase due process? Don writes the program and says, should we change the laws to make it easier to convict these perpetrators in order to lower the cost to women for reporting these crimes?
We should make it so that, women, also I want to stop saying women. Victims aren't just women.
Yeah,
there's
all sorts
of people who are victims. So that's problematic in itself. And we need to stop seeing women as people who need our help. We need to start looking at the abusers, the rapists, the people who are molesting children as the ones that we're mad at. And no, due process means nothing. We do need to change the laws. We need to stop putting it so that the defense, the accused, as people would like to say, are the ones who get to decide whether they get a bench trial, which means there's just the judge and a lawyer and you and the person who hurt you in the room. That's not fair. I think that the community should be involved. I think that the prosecutor should be the one deciding if there's a jury. I think we should give more rights to victims. Did you know that they can choose to remain silent and not speak at all during court, never get on stand, and that you're the only one that has to keep telling your story? I didn't know that until it happened to me. Yeah. I think we need to change the law. I think that the law was written by a bunch of men who were hitting their wives and being awful, and it's time that we change it.
But when you say due process, I don't know if you're being flip, but I mean, I think we can acknowledge that there's not a large percentage of false claims while saying due process matters.
Yeah.
I think it sounds like what you're saying is that you think the system favors the accused?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Sorry. Okay. I'm just all shaky right now because this is bringing back so many things, so I don't really know what to even
Real quick, Megan, how do you feel about the system due process?
We also have a backlog of SANE kits. So you go for sexual assault nurse exams, and there's a backlog currently of the evidence. I do believe that we have a long way to go in making our laws more fair and impartial. What's happening right now with the Kavanaugh case, she's being testifying, I believe, on Thursday this week.
Well,
is
at least
true?
That's still scheduled. I mean, it feels like there's an ocean of time between now and Thursday, so who knows?
Yeah, and that doesn't feel like a very fair process to me, who she's preparing her testimony for, who she'll be in front of, and what they've already stated about how they're going to react to it.
Okay. Some quick final thoughts from you on due process, Rachel?
I absolutely believe in due process, and I do believe that everyone is innocent until they are proven guilty. However, having the weight of proof be on by re-traumatizing someone over and over again and having all these backlogs and not providing the proof because we have to somehow, as victims, prove that we are innocent before they're even willing to consider our perpetrator to be guilty.
You as a victim feel like you're on trial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rachel Pezda and Ilhan Ali sharing their stories, and I'm really grateful. Thank you for being willing to do that.
Thank you for having us.
In many ways, I'm sorry for all of the circumstances. Megan DeChateauview from Willow, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
As always, and the conversation continues in many circles. Why I Didn't Report is a hashtag, social media as well, and I know we're not done with this conversation. More Connections coming up.